his actions. He wanted you to juggle reality for him, so that his greatness would remain, but the State Science Institute would be wiped out, as if it had never existed. And you're the only one who could do it for him. Why I? Because you're the victim. She looked at him, startled. He spoke intently. He felt a sudden, violent clarity of perception, as if a surge of energy were rushing into the activity of sight, fusing the half-seen and half-grasped into a single shape and direction. Dagny, they're doing something that we've never understood. They know something which we don't, but should discover. I can't see it fully yet, but I'm beginning to see parts of it. That looter from the State Science Institute was scared when I refused to help him pretend that he was just an honest buyer of my metal. He was scared way deep. Of what? I don't know. Public opinion was just his name for it, but it's not the full name. Why should he have been scared? He has the guns, the jails, the laws. He could have seized the whole of my mills if he wished, and nobody would have risen to defend me, and he knew it. So why should he have cared what I thought? But he did. It was I who had to tell him that he wasn't a looter, but my customer and friend. That's what he needed from me, and that's what Dr. Stadler needed from you. It was you who had to act as if he were a great man who had never tried to destroy your rail and my metal. I don't know what it is that they think they accomplish, but they want us to pretend that we see the world as they pretend they see it. They need some sort of sanction from us. I don't know the nature of that sanction. But Dagny, I know that if we value our lives, we must not give it to them. If they put you on a torture rack, don't give it to them. Let them destroy your railroad and my mills, but don't give it to them. Because I know this much. I know that that's our only chance. She had remained standing still before him, looking attentively at the faint outline of some shape she too had tried to grasp. Yes, she said. Yes, I know what you've seen in them. I've felt it too, but it's only like something brushing past that's gone before I know I've seen it, like a touch of cold air, and what's left is always the feeling that I should have stopped it. I know that you're right. I can't understand their game, but this much is right. We must not see the world as they want us to see it. It's some sort of fraud, very ancient and very vast, and the key to break it is to check every premise they teach us, to question every precept, to... She whirled to him at a sudden thought, but she cut the motion and the words in the same instant. The next words would have been the ones she did not want to say to him. She stood looking at him with a slow, bright smile of curiosity. Somewhere within him he knew the thought she would not name, but he knew it only in that prenatal shape which has to find its words in the future. He did not pause to grasp it now, because in the flooding brightness of what he felt, another thought, which was its predecessor, had become clear to him and had been holding him for many minutes past. He rose, approached her, and took her in his arms. He held the length of her body pressed to his, as if their bodies were two currents rising upward together, each to a single point, each carrying the whole of their consciousness to the meeting of their lips. What she felt in that moment contained, as one nameless part of it, the knowledge of the beauty in the posture of his body as he held her, as they stood in the middle of a room high above the lights of the city. What he knew, what he had discovered tonight, was that his recaptured love of existence had not been given back to him by the return of his desire for her, but that the desire had returned after he had regained his world, the love, the value, and the sense of his world, and that the desire was not an answer to her body, but a celebration of himself and of his will to live. He did not know it. He did not think of it. He was past the need of words. But in the moment when he felt the response of her body to his, he felt also the unadmitted knowledge that that which he had called her depravity was her highest virtue, this capacity of hers to feel the joy of being as he felt it. Chapter 2. The Aristocracy of Pull. The calendar in the sky beyond the window of her office said September 2nd. Dagny leaned wearily across her desk. The first light to snap on at the approach of dusk was always the ray that hit the calendar. When the white glowing page appeared above the roofs, it blurred the city, hastening the darkness. She had looked at that distant page every evening of the months behind her. "Your days are numbered," it had seemed to say, as if it were marking a progression toward something it knew, but she didn't. Once it had clocked her race to build the John Galt line. Now it was clocking her race against an unknown destroyer. One by one, the men who had built new towns in Colorado had departed into some silent unknown from which no voice or person had yet returned. The towns they had left were dying. Some of the factories they built had remained ownerless and locked. Others had been seized by the local authorities. The machines in both stood still. She had felt as if a dark map of Colorado were spread before her like a traffic control panel, with a few lights scattered through its mountains. One after another, the lights had gone out. One after another, the men had vanished. There had been a pattern about it which she felt but could not define. She had become able to predict, almost with certainty, who would go next and when. She was unable to grasp the why. Of the men who had once greeted her descent from the cab of an engine on the platform of Wyatt Junction, only Ted Nielsen was left, still running the plant of Nielsen Motors. "Ted, you won't be the next one to go," she had asked him on his recent visit to New York. She had asked it, trying to smile. He had answered grimly, "I hope not." "What do you mean, you hope? Aren't you sure?" He had said slowly, heavily, "Dagny, I've always thought that I'd rather die than stop working. But so did the men who are gone. It seems impossible to me that I could ever want to quit. But a year ago it seemed impossible that they ever could. Those men were my friends. They knew what their going would do to us, the survivors. They would not have gone like that without a word, leaving to us the added terror of the inexplicable, unless they had some reason of supreme importance. A month ago, Roger Marsh of Marsh Electric told me that he'd have himself chained to his desk so that he wouldn't be able to leave it, no matter what ghastly temptation struck him. He was furious with anger at the men who'd left. He swore to me that he'd never do it. And if it's something that I can't resist, he said, I swear that I'll keep enough of my mind to leave you a letter and give you some hint of what it is, so that you won't have to rack your brain in the kind of dread we're both feeling now. That's what he swore. 2 weeks ago, he went. He left me no letter. Dagny, I can't tell what I'll do when I see it. Whatever it was that they saw when they went." It seemed to her that some destroyer was moving soundlessly through the country, and the lights were dying at his touch. Someone, she thought bitterly, who had reversed the principle of the 20th century motor and was now turning kinetic energy into static. That was the enemy, she thought, as she sat at her desk in the gathering twilight, with whom she was running a race. The monthly report from Quentin Daniels lay on her desk. She could not be certain as yet that Daniels would solve the secret of the motor. But the destroyer, she thought, was moving swiftly, surely, at an ever-accelerating tempo. She wondered whether, by the time she rebuilt the motor, there would be any world left to use it. She had liked Quentin Daniels from the moment he entered her office on their first interview. He was a lanky man in his early 30s, with a homely, angular face and an attractive smile. A hint of the smile remained in his features at all times, particularly when he listened. It was a look of good-natured amusement, as if he were swiftly and patiently discarding the irrelevant in the words he heard and going straight to the point a moment ahead of the speaker. "Why did you refuse to work for Dr. Stadler?" she asked. The hint of his smile grew harder and more stressed. This was as near as he came to showing an emotion. The emotion was anger. But he answered in his even, unhurried drawl, "You know, Dr. Stadler once said that the first word of free scientific inquiry was redundant. He seems to have forgotten it." "Well, I'll just say that governmental scientific inquiry is a contradiction in terms." She asked him what position he held at the Utah Institute of Technology. "Night watchman," he answered. "What?" she gasped. "Night watchman," he repeated politely, as if she had not caught the words, as if there were no cause for astonishment. Under her questioning, he explained that he did not like any of the scientific foundations left in existence, that he would have liked a job in the research laboratory of some big industrial concern, but which one of them can afford to undertake any long-range work nowadays, and why should they? So when the Utah Institute of Technology was closed for lack of funds, he had remained there as night watchman and sole inhabitant of the place. The salary was sufficient to pay for his needs, and the Institute's laboratory was there intact for his own private, undisturbed use.
"So you're doing research work of your own?"
"That's right."
"For what purpose?"
"For my own pleasure."
"What do you intend to do if you discover something of scientific importance or commercial value? Do you intend to put it to some public use?"
"I don't know. I don't think so."
"Haven't you any desire to be of service to humanity?"
"I don't talk that kind of language, Miss Taggart."
"I don't think you do either." She laughed. "I think we'll get along together, you and I."
"We will." When she had told him the story of the motor, when he had studied the manuscript, he made no comment, but merely said that he would take the job on any terms she named. She asked him to choose his own terms. She protested in astonishment against the low monthly salary he quoted. "Miss Taggart," he said, "if there's something that I won't take, it's something for nothing. I don't know how long you might have to pay me, or whether you'll get anything at all in return. I'll gamble on my own mind. I won't let anybody else do it. I don't collect for an intention, but I sure do intend to collect for goods delivered. If I succeed, that's when I'll skin you alive, because what I want then is a percentage, and it's going to be high, but it's going to be worth your while." When he named the percentage he wanted, she laughed.
"That is skinning me alive, and it will be worth my while."
"Okay." They agreed that it was to be her private project, and that he was to be her private employee. Neither of them wanted to have to deal with the interference of the Taggart Research Department. He asked to remain in Utah, in his post of watchman, where he had all the laboratory equipment and all the privacy he needed. The project was to remain confidential between them until and unless he succeeded. "Miss Taggart," he said in conclusion, "I don't know how many years it will take me to solve this, if ever. But I know that if I spend the rest of my life on it and succeed, I will die satisfied." He added, "There's only one thing that I want more than to solve it. It's to meet the man who has." Once a month, since his return to Utah, she had sent him a check, and he had sent her a report on his work. It was too early to hope, but his reports were the only bright points in the stagnant fog of her days in the office. She raised her head as she finished reading his pages. The calendar in the distance said September 2nd. The lights of the city had grown beneath it, spreading and glittering. She thought of Reardon. She wished he were in the city.
She wished she would see him tonight. Then, noticing the date, she remembered suddenly that she had to rush home to dress, because she had to attend Jim's wedding tonight. She had not seen Jim outside the office for over a year. She had not met his fiancée, but she had read enough about the engagement in the newspapers. She rose from her desk in wearily distasteful resignation. It seemed easier to attend the wedding than to bother explaining her absence afterwards. She was hurrying across the concourse of the terminal when she heard a voice calling "Miss Taggart," with a strange note of urgency and reluctance together. It stopped her abruptly. She took a few seconds to realize that it was the old man at the cigar stand who had called. "I've been waiting to catch sight of you for days, Miss Taggart. I've been extremely anxious to speak to you." There was an odd expression on his face, the look of an effort not to look frightened. "I'm sorry," she said, smiling. "I've been rushing in and out of the building all week and didn't have time to stop." He did not smile. "Miss Taggart, that cigarette with the dollar sign that you gave me some months ago, where did you get it?" She stood still for a moment. "I'm afraid that's a long, complicated story," she answered. "Have you any way of getting in touch with the person who gave it to you?" "I suppose so, though I'm not too sure." "Why?" "Would he tell you where he got it?" "I don't know." "What makes you suspect that he wouldn't?" He hesitated, then asked, "Miss Taggart, what do you do when you have to tell someone something which you know to be impossible?" She chuckled. "The man who gave me the cigarette said that in such a case, one must check one's premises." "He did." "About the cigarette?" "Well, no, not exactly." "But why? What is it you have to tell me?" "Miss Taggart, I have inquired all over the world. I have checked every source of information in and about the tobacco industry. I have had that cigarette stub put through a chemical analysis. There is no plant that manufactures that kind of paper. The flavoring elements in that tobacco have never been used in any smoking mixture I could find. That cigarette was machine-made, but it was not made in any factory I know. And I know them all. Miss Taggart, to the best of my knowledge, that cigarette was not made anywhere on Earth." Reardon stood by, watching absently while the waiter wheeled the dinner table out of his hotel room. Ken Daniger had left. The room was half dark. By an unspoken agreement, they had kept the lights low during their dinner so that Daniger's face would not be noticed and, perhaps, recognized by the waiters. They had had to meet furtively, like criminals who could not be seen together. They could not meet in their offices or in their homes, only in the crowded anonymity of a city, in his suite at the Wayne Falkland Hotel. There could be a fine of $10,000 and 10 years of imprisonment for each of them if it became known that he had agreed to deliver to Daniger 4,000 tons of structural shapes of Reardon metal. They had not discussed that law at their dinner together, or their motives, or the risk they were taking. They had merely talked business. Speaking clearly and dryly, as he always spoke at any conference, Daniger had explained that half of his original order would be sufficient to brace such tunnels as would cave in, if he delayed the bracing much longer, and to recondition the mines of the Confederated Coal Company, gone bankrupt, which he had purchased 3 weeks ago. "It's an excellent property, but in rotten condition. They had a nasty accident there last month, cave-in and gas explosion. 40 men killed." He had added, in the monotone of reciting some impersonal statistical report, "The newspapers are yelling that coal is now the most crucial commodity in the country. They are also yelling that the coal operators are profiteering on the oil shortage. One gang in Washington is yelling that I am expanding too much and something should be done to stop me because I am becoming a monopoly. Another gang in Washington is yelling that I am not expanding enough and something should be done to let the government seize my mines
because I am greedy for profits and unwilling to satisfy the public's need of fuel. At my present rate of profit, this Confederated coal property will bring back the money I spent on it in 47 years. I have no children. I bought it because there's one customer I don't dare leave without coal, and that's Taggart Transcontinental. I keep thinking of what would happen if the railroads collapsed. He had stopped, then added, I don't know why I still care about that, but I do. Those people in Washington don't seem to have a clear picture of what that would be like. I have. Reardon had said, I'll deliver the metal. When you need the other half of your order, let me know. I'll deliver that, too. At the end of the dinner, Daniger had said, in the same precise, impassive tone, the tone of a man who knows the exact meaning of his words, if any employee of yours or mine discovers this and attempts private blackmail, I will pay it within reason. But I will not pay if he has friends in Washington. If any of those come around, then I go to jail. Then we go together, Reardon had said. Standing alone in his half-darkened room, Reardon noted that the prospect of going to jail left him blankly indifferent. He remembered the time when, aged 14, faint with hunger, he would not steal fruit from a sidewalk stand. Now, the possibility of being sent to jail, if this dinner was a felony, meant no more to him than the possibility of being run over by a truck. An ugly physical accident without any moral significance. He thought that he had been made to hide, as a guilty secret, the only business transaction he had enjoyed in a year's work, and that he was hiding, as a guilty secret, his nights with Dagny, the only hours that kept him alive. He felt that there was some connection between the two secrets, some essential connection which he had to discover. He could not grasp it. He could not find the words to name it, but he felt that the day when he would find them, he would answer every question of his life. He stood against the wall, his head thrown back, his eyes closed, and thought of Dagny. And then he felt that no questions could matter to him any longer. He thought that he would see her tonight, almost hating it, because tomorrow morning seemed so close, and then he would have to leave her. He wondered whether he could remain in town tomorrow, or whether he should leave now, without seeing her, so that he could wait, so that he could always have it ahead of him, the moment of closing his hands over her shoulders and looking down at her face. You're going insane, he thought. But he knew that if she were beside him through every hour of his days, it would still be the same. He would never have enough of it. He would have to invent some senseless form of torture for himself in order to bear it. He knew he would see her tonight, and the thought of leaving without it made the pleasure greater, a moment's torture to underscore his certainty of the hours ahead. He would leave the light on in her living room, he thought, and hold her across the bed, and see nothing but the curve of the strip of light running from her waist to her ankle, a single line drawing the whole shape of her long, slim body in the darkness. Then he would pull her head into the light, to see her face, to see it falling back, unresisting, her hair over his arm, her eyes closed, the face drawn as in a look of pain, her mouth open to him. He stood at the wall, waiting, to let all the events of the day drop away from him, to feel free, to know that the next span of time was his. When the door of his room flew open without warning, he did not quite hear or believe it at first. He saw the silhouette of a woman, then of a bellboy who put down a suitcase and vanished. The voice he heard was Lillian's. Why, Henry, all alone and in the dark? She pressed a light switch by the door. She stood there, fastidiously groomed, wearing a pale beige traveling suit that looked as if she had traveled under glass. She was smiling and pulling her gloves off with the air of having reached home. Are you in for the evening, dear? She asked. Or were you going out? He did not know how long a time passed before he answered, What are you doing here? Why, don't you remember that Jim Taggart invited us to his wedding? It's tonight. I didn't intend to go to his wedding. Oh, but I did. Why didn't you tell me this morning before I left?
to surprise you, darling. She laughed gaily. It's practically impossible to drag you to any social function, but I thought you might do it like this, on the spur of the moment, just to go out and have a good time, as married couples are supposed to. I thought you wouldn't mind it. You've been staying overnight in New York so often. He saw the casual glance thrown at him from under the brim of her fashionably tilted hat. He said nothing.
Of course I was running a risk, she said. You might have been taking somebody out to dinner.
He said nothing.
Or were you perhaps intending to return home tonight?
No.
Did you have an engagement for this evening?
No.
Fine.
She pointed at her suitcase. I brought my evening clothes. Will you bet me a corsage of orchids that I can get dressed faster than you can? He thought that Dagny would be at her brother's wedding tonight. The evening did not matter to him any longer. I'll take you out, if you wish, he said, but not to that wedding.
Oh, but that's where I want to go. It's the most preposterous event of the season, and everybody's been looking forward to it for weeks, all my friends. I wouldn't miss it for the world. There isn't any better show in town, nor better publicized. It's a perfectly ridiculous marriage, but just about what you'd expect from Jim Taggart.
She was moving casually through the room, glancing around, as if getting acquainted with an unfamiliar place.
I haven't been in New York for years, she said.
Not with you, that is. Not on any formal occasion. He noticed the pause in the aimless wandering of her eyes, a glance that stopped briefly on a filled ashtray and moved on. He felt a stab of revulsion. She saw it in his face and laughed gaily.
Oh, but darling, I'm not relieved. I'm disappointed. I did hope I'd find a few cigarette butts smeared with lipstick.
He gave her credit for the admission of the spying, even if under cover of a joke. But something in the stressed frankness of her manner made him wonder whether she was joking. For the flash of an instant, he felt that she had told him the truth. He dismissed the impression, because he could not conceive of it as possible.
I'm afraid that you'll never be human, she said. So I'm sure that I have no rival. And if I have, which I doubt, darling, I don't think I'll worry about it, because if it's a person who's always available on call, without appointment, well, everybody knows what sort of a person that is.
He thought that he would have to be careful. He had been about to slap her face.
Lillian, I think you know, he said, that humor of this kind is more than I can stand.
Oh, you're so serious, she laughed. I keep forgetting it. You're so serious about everything, particularly yourself. Then she whirled to him suddenly, her smile gone. She had the strange, pleading look which he had seen in her face at times, a look that seemed made of sincerity and courage.
You prefer to be serious, Henry? All right. How long do you wish me to exist somewhere in the basement of your life? How lonely do you want me to become? I've asked nothing of you. I've let you live your life as you pleased. Can't you give me one evening? Oh, I know you hate parties and you'll be bored, but it means a great deal to me. Call it empty social vanity. I want to appear for once with my husband. I suppose you never think of it in such terms, but you're an important man. You're envied, hated, respected, and feared. You're a man whom any woman would be proud to show off as her husband. You may say it's a low form of feminine ostentation, but that's the form of any woman's happiness. You don't live by such standards, but I do. Can't you give me this much, at the price of a few hours of boredom? Can't you be strong enough to fulfill your obligation and to perform a husband's duty? Can't you go there not for your own sake, but mine? Not because you want to go, but only because I want it.
Dagny, he thought desperately. Dagny, who had never said a word about his life at home, who had never made a claim, uttered a reproach, or asked a question. He could not appear before her with his wife. He could not let her see him as the husband being proudly shown off. He wished he could die now, in this moment, before he committed this action, because he knew that he would commit it. Because he had accepted his secret as guilt and promised himself to take its consequences. Because he had granted that the right was with Lillian, and he was able to bear any form of damnation, but not able to deny the right when it was claimed of him. Because he knew that the reason for his refusal to go was the reason that gave him no right to refuse. Because he heard the pleading cry in his mind, "Oh God, Lillian, anything but that party!" And he did not allow himself to beg for mercy. He said evenly, his voice lifeless and firm, "All right, Lillian, I'll go." The wedding veil of rose point lace caught on the splintered floor of her tenement bedroom. Cheryl Brooks lifted it cautiously, stepping to look at herself in a crooked mirror that hung on the wall. She had been photographed here all day, as she had been many times in the past 2 months. She still smiled with incredulous gratitude when newspaper people wanted to take her picture, but she wished they would not do it so often. An aging sob sister, who had a drippy love column in print and the bitter wisdom of a policewoman in person, had taken Cheryl under her protection weeks ago, when the girl had first been thrown into press interviews as into a meat grinder. Today the sob sister had chased the reporters out, had snapped, all right, beat it," at the neighbors, had slammed Cheryl's door in their faces, and had helped her to dress. She was to drive Cheryl to the wedding. She had discovered that there was no one else to do it. The wedding veil, the white satin gown, the delicate slippers, and the strand of pearls at her throat had cost 500 times the price of the entire contents of Cheryl's room. A bed took most of the room's space, and the rest was taken by a chest of drawers, one chair, and her few dresses hanging behind a faded curtain. The huge hoop skirt of the wedding gown brushed against the walls when she moved, her slender figure swaying above the skirt in the dramatic contrast of a tight, severe, long-sleeved bodice. The gown had been made by the best designer in the city.
"You see, when I got the job in the dime store, I could have moved to a better room," she said to the sob sister in apology. "But I don't think it matters much where you sleep at night, so I saved my money, because I'll need it for something important in the future."
She stopped and smiled, shaking her head dazedly.
"I thought I'd need it," she said.
"You look fine," said the sob sister. "You can't see much in that alleged mirror, but you're okay."
"The way all this happened, I haven't had time to catch up with myself. But you see, Jim's wonderful. He doesn't mind it that I'm only a sales girl from a dime store living in a place like this. He doesn't hold it against me."
"Uh-huh," said the sob sister. Her face looked grim.
Cheryl remembered the wonder of the first time Jim Taggart had come here. He had come one evening without warning, a month after their first meeting, when she had given up hope of ever seeing him again. She had been miserably embarrassed. She had felt as if she were trying to hold a sunrise within the space of a mud puddle. But Jim had smiled, sitting on her only chair, looking at her flushed face and at her room. Then he had told her to put on her coat, and he had taken her to dinner at the most expensive restaurant in the city. He had smiled at her uncertainty, at her awkwardness, at her terror of picking the wrong fork, and at the look of enchantment in her eyes. She had not known what he thought, but he had known that she was stunned not by the place, but by his bringing her there, that she barely touched the costly food, that she took the dinner not as booty from a rich sucker, as all the girls he knew would have taken it, but as some shining award she had never expected to deserve. He had come back to her 2 weeks later, and then their dates had grown progressively more frequent. He would drive up to the dime store at the closing hour, and she would see her fellow sales girls gaping at her, at his limousine, at the uniformed chauffeur who opened the door for her. He would take her to the best nightclubs, and when he introduced her to his friends, he would say, "Miss Brooks works in the dime store in Madison Square." She would see the strange expressions on their faces, and Jim watching them with a hint of mockery in his eyes. He wanted to spare her the need of pretense or embarrassment, she thought with gratitude. He had the strength to be honest and not to care whether others approved of him or not, she thought with admiration. But she felt an odd burning pain, new to her, the night she heard some woman who worked for a highbrow political magazine say to her companion at the next table, "How generous of Jim!" Had he wished, she would have given him the only kind of payment she could offer in return. She was grateful that he did not seek it. But she felt as if their relationship was an immense debt, and she had nothing to pay it with, except her silent worship. He did not need her worship, she thought. There were evenings when he came to take her out, but remained in her room instead and talked to her, while she listened in silence. It always happened unexpectedly, with a kind of peculiar abruptness, as if he had not intended doing it, but something burst within him and he had to speak. Then he sat slumped on her bed, unaware of his surroundings and of her presence, yet his eyes jerked to her face once in a while, as if he had to be certain that a living being heard him. "It wasn't for myself. It wasn't for myself at all. Why don't they believe me, those people? I had to grant the union's demands to cut down the trains, and the moratorium on bonds was the only way I could do it. So that's why Wesley gave it to me, for the workers, not for myself. All the newspapers said that I was a great example for all businessmen to follow. A businessman with a sense of social responsibility. That's what they said. It's true, isn't it? Isn't it? What was wrong about that moratorium? What if we did skip a few technicalities? It was for a good purpose. Everyone agrees that anything you do is good, so long as it's not for yourself. But she won't give me credit for a good purpose. She doesn't think anybody's any good except herself. My sister is a ruthless, conceited bitch who won't take anyone's ideas but her own. Why do they keep looking at me that way? She and Reardon and all those people. Why are they so sure they're right? If I acknowledge their superiority in the material realm, why don't they acknowledge mine in the spiritual? They have the brain, but I have the heart. They have the capacity to produce wealth, but I have the capacity to love. Isn't mine the greater capacity? Hasn't it been recognized as the greatest through all the centuries of human history? Why won't they recognize it? Why are they so sure they're great? And if they're great and I'm not, isn't that exactly why they should bow to me, because I'm not? Wouldn't that be an act of true humanity? It takes no kindness to respect a man who deserves respect. It's only a payment which he's earned. To give an unearned respect is the supreme gesture of charity. But they're incapable of charity. They're not human. They feel no concern for anyone's need or weakness. No concern. And no pity. She could understand little of it, but she understood that he was unhappy and that somebody had hurt him. He saw the pain of tenderness in her face, the pain of indignation against his enemies, and he saw the glance intended for heroes, given to him by a person able to experience the emotion behind that glance. She did not know why she felt certain that she was the only one to whom he could confess his torture. She took it as a special honor, as one more gift. The only way to be worthy of him, she thought, was never to ask him for anything. He offered her money once, and she refused it, with such a bright, painful flare of anger in her eyes that he did not attempt it again. The anger was at herself. She wondered whether she had done something to make him think she was that kind of person. But she did not want to be ungrateful for his concern, or to embarrass him by her ugly poverty. She wanted to show him her eagerness to rise and justify his favor,
So she told him that he could help her, if he wished, by helping her to find a better job. He did not answer. In the weeks that followed, she waited, but he never mentioned the subject. She blamed herself. She thought that she had offended him, that he had taken it as an attempt to use him. When he gave her an emerald bracelet, she was too shocked to understand. Trying desperately not to hurt him, she pleaded that she could not accept it. "Why not?" he asked. "It isn't as if you were a bad woman paying the usual price for it. Are you afraid that I'll start making demands? Don't you trust me?" He laughed aloud at her stammering embarrassment. He smiled, with an odd kind of enjoyment, all through the evening when they went to a nightclub and she wore the bracelet with her shabby black dress. He made her wear that bracelet again on the night when he took her to a party, a great reception given by Mrs. Cornelius Pope. If he considered her good enough to bring into the home of his friends, she thought, the illustrious friends whose names she had seen on the inaccessible mountain peaks that were the society columns of the newspapers, she could not embarrass him by wearing her old dress. She spent her year's savings on an evening gown of bright green chiffon with a low neckline, a belt of yellow roses, and a rhinestone buckle. When she entered the Stern residence with the cold, brilliant lights and a terrace suspended over the roofs of skyscrapers, she knew that her dress was wrong for the occasion, though she could not tell why. But she kept her posture proudly straight, and she smiled with the courageous trust of a kitten when it sees a hand extended to play. People gathered to have a good time would not hurt anyone, she thought. At the end of an hour, her attempt to smile had become a helpless, bewildered plea. Then the smile went as she watched the people around her. She saw that the trim, confident girls had a nasty insolence of manner when they spoke to Jim, as if they did not respect him and never had. One of them in particular, a Betty Pope, the daughter of the hostess, kept making remarks to him which Cheryl could not understand, because she could not believe that she understood them correctly. No one had paid any attention to her at first, except for a few astonished glances at her gown. After a while she saw them looking at her. She heard an elderly woman ask Jim, in the anxious tone of referring to some distinguished family she had missed knowing, "Did you say Miss Brooks of Madison Square?" She saw an odd smile on Jim's face when he answered, making his voice sound peculiarly clear, "Yes, the cosmetics counter of Raleigh's 5 and 10. Then she saw some people becoming too polite to her, and others moving away in a pointed manner, and most of them being senselessly awkward in simple bewilderment, and Jim watching silently with that odd smile. She tried to get out of the way, out of their notice. As she slipped by along the edge of the room, she heard some man say with a shrug, "Well, Jim Taggart is one of the most powerful men in Washington at the moment." He did not say it respectfully. Out on the terrace, where it was darker, she heard two men talking and wondered why she felt certain that they were talking about her. One of them said, "Taggart can afford to do it if he pleases," and the other said something about the horse of some Roman emperor named Caligula. She looked at the lone straight shaft of the Taggart building rising in the distance, and then she thought that she understood. These people hated Jim because they envied him. Whatever they were, she thought, whatever their names and their money, none of them had an achievement comparable to his. None of them had defied the whole country to build a railroad everybody thought impossible. For the first time, she saw that she did have something to offer Jim. These people were as mean and small as the people from whom she had escaped in Buffalo. He was as lonely as she had always been, and the sincerity of her feeling was the only recognition he had found. Then she walked back into the ballroom, cutting straight through the crowd, and the only thing left of the tears she had tried to hold back in the darkness of the terrace was the fiercely luminous sparkle of her eyes. If he wished to stand by her openly, even though she was only a shop girl, if he wished to flaunt it, if he had brought her here to face the indignation of his friends,
than it was the gesture of a courageous man defying their opinion, and she was willing to match his courage by serving as the scarecrow of the occasion. But she was glad when it was over, when she sat beside him in his car, driving home through the darkness. She felt a bleak kind of relief. Her battling defiance ebbed into a strange, desolate feeling. She tried not to give way to it. Jim said little. He sat looking sullenly out the car window. She wondered whether she had disappointed him in some manner. On the stoop of her rooming house, she said to him forlornly,
"I'm sorry if I let you down."
He did not answer for a moment, and then he asked, "What would you say if I asked you to marry me?" She looked at him. She looked around them. There was a filthy mattress hanging on somebody's windowsill, a pawn shop across the street, a garbage pail at the stoop beside them. One did not ask such a question in such a place. She did not know what it meant, and she answered,
"I guess I haven't any sense of humor."
"This is a proposal, my dear." Then this was the way they reached their first kiss. With tears running down her face, tears unshed at the party, tears of shock, of happiness, of thinking that this should be happiness, and of a low, desolate voice telling her that this was not the way she would have wanted it to happen. She had not thought about the newspapers until the day when Jim told her to come to his apartment, and she found it crowded with people who had notebooks, cameras, and flashbulbs. When she saw her picture in the papers for the first time, a picture of them together, Jim's arm around her, she giggled with delight and wondered proudly whether every person in the city had seen it. After a while, the delight vanished. They kept photographing her at the dime store counter, in the subway, on the stoop of the tenement house, in her miserable room. She would have taken money from Jim now and run to hide in some obscure hotel for the weeks of their engagement, but he did not offer it. He seemed to want her to remain where she was. They printed pictures of Jim at his desk, in the concourse of the Taggart Terminal, by the steps of his private railway car, at a formal banquet in Washington. The huge spreads of full newspaper pages, the articles in magazines, the radio voices, the newsreels, all were a single, long, sustained scream about the Cinderella girl and the Democratic businessman. She told herself not to be suspicious when she felt uneasy. She told herself not to be ungrateful when she felt hurt. She felt it only in a few rare moments, when she awakened in the middle of the night and lay in the silence of her room, unable to sleep. She knew that it would take her years to recover, to believe, to understand. She was reeling through her days like a person with a sunstroke, seeing nothing but the figure of Jim Taggart as she had seen him first on the night of his great triumph. "Listen, kid," the sob sister said to her when she stood in her room for the last time, the lace of the wedding veil streaming like crystal foam from her hair to the blotched planks of the floor. "You think that if one gets hurt in life, it's through one's own sins. And that's true in the long run. But there are people who will try to hurt you through the good they see in you, knowing that it's the good, needing it, and punishing you for it. Don't let it break you when you discover that."
"I don't think I'm afraid," she said,
looking intently straight before her, the radiance of her smile melting the earnestness of her glance.
"I have no right to be afraid of anything. I'm too happy. You see, I always thought that there wasn't any sense in people saying that all you can do in life is suffer. I wasn't going to knuckle down to that and give up. I thought that things could happen which were beautiful and very great. I didn't expect it to happen to me. Not so much and so soon. But I'll try to live up to it."
"Money is the root of all evil," said James Taggart. "Money can't buy happiness. Love will conquer any barrier and any social distance. That may be a bromide, boys, but that's how I feel." He stood under the lights of the ballroom of the Wayne Falkland Hotel in a circle of reporters who had closed about him the moment the wedding ceremony ended.
He heard the crowd of guests beating like a tide beyond the circle. Cheryl stood beside him, her white-gloved hand on the black of his sleeve. She was still trying to hear the words of the ceremony, not quite believing that she had heard them. "How do you feel, Mrs. Taggart?" She heard the question from somewhere in the circle of reporters. It was like the jolt of returning to consciousness. Two words suddenly made everything real to her. She smiled and whispered, choking,
I'm very happy.
At opposite ends of the ballroom, Orrin Boyle, who seemed too stout for his full dress clothes, and Bertram Scudder, who seemed too meager for his, surveyed the crowd of guests with the same thought, though neither of them admitted that he was thinking it. Orrin Boyle half told himself that he was looking for the faces of friends, and Bertram Scudder suggested to himself that he was gathering material for an article. But both, unknown to each other, were drawing a mental chart of the faces they saw, classifying them under two headings which, if named, would have read favor and fear. There were men whose presence signified a special protection extended to James Taggart, and men whose presence confessed a desire to avoid his hostility. Those who represented a hand lowered to pull him up, and those who represented a back bent to let him climb. By the unwritten code of the day, nobody received or accepted an invitation from a man of public prominence except in token of one or the other of these motives. Those in the first group were, for the most part, youthful. They had come from Washington. Those in the second group were older. They were businessmen. Orrin Boyle and Bertram Scudder were men who used words as a public instrument, to be avoided in the privacy of one's own mind. Words were a commitment, carrying implications which they did not wish to face. They needed no words for their chart. The classification was done by physical means. A respectful movement of their eyebrows, equivalent to the emotion of the word "so" for the first group, and a sarcastic movement of their lips, equivalent to the emotion of "well, well" for the second. One face blew up the smooth working of their calculating mechanisms for a moment. When they saw the cold blue eyes and blonde hair of Hank Reardon, their muscles tore at the register of the second group in the equivalent of "oh boy." The sum of the chart was an estimate of James Taggart's power. It added up to an impressive total. They knew that James Taggart was fully aware of it when they saw him moving among his guests. He walked briskly, in a Morse code pattern of short dashes and brief stops, with a manner of faint irritation, as if conscious of the number of people whom his displeasure might worry. The hint of a smile on his face had a flavor of gloating, as if he knew that the act of coming to honor him was an act that disgraced the men who had come, as if he knew and enjoyed it. A tail of figures kept trailing and shifting behind him, as if their function were to give him the pleasure of ignoring them. Mr. Moen flickered briefly among the tail, and Dr. Pritchett, and Balfe Eubank. The most persistent one was Paul Larkin. He kept describing circles around Taggart, as if trying to acquire a suntan by means of an occasional ray, his wistful smile pleading to be noticed. Taggart's eyes swept over the crowd once in a while, swiftly and furtively, in the manner of a prowler's flashlight. This, in the muscular shorthand legible to Orrin Boyle, meant that Taggart was looking for someone and did not want anyone to know it. The search ended when Eugene Lawson came to shake Taggart's hand and to say, his wet lower lip twisting like a cushion to soften the blow, "Mr. Mouch couldn't come, Jim. Mr. Mouch is so sorry. He had a special plane chartered, but at the last minute things came up. Crucial national problems, you know." Taggart stood still, did not answer, and frowned. Orrin Boyle burst out laughing. Taggart turned to him so sharply that the others melted away without waiting for a command to vanish. "What do you think you're doing?" snapped Taggart.
"Having a good time, Jimmy. Just having a good time," said Boyle.
"Wesley is your boy,
wasn't he?"
"I know somebody who's my boy, and he'd better not forget it."
"Who? Larkin?"
"Well, no, I don't think you're talking about Larkin."
And if it's not Larkin that you're talking about, why then I think you ought to be careful in your use of the possessive pronouns. I don't mind the age classification. I know I look young for my years, but I'm just allergic to pronouns.
That's very smart, but you're going to get too smart one of these days.
If I do, you just go ahead and make the most of it, Jimmy. If. The trouble with people who overreach themselves is that they have short memories. You'd better remember who got Reardon Metal choked off the market for you. Why, I remember who promised to. That was the party who then pulled every string he could lay his hands on to try to prevent that particular directive from being issued, because he figured he might need rail of Reardon Metal in the future. Because you spent $10,000 pouring liquor into people you hoped would prevent the directive about the bond moratorium.
That's right. So I did. I had friends who had railroad bonds. And besides, I have friends in Washington too, Jimmy.
Well, your friends beat mine on that moratorium business, but mine beat yours on Reardon Metal. And I'm not forgetting it. But what the hell? It's all right with me. That's the way to share things around. Only don't you try to fool me, Jimmy. Save the act for the suckers.
If you don't believe that I've always tried to do my best for you,
sure you have. The best that could be expected, all things considered. And you'll continue to do it, too, so long as I've got somebody you need. And not a minute longer. So I just wanted to remind you that I've got my own friends in Washington. Friends that money can't buy. Just like yours, Jimmy.
What do you think you mean?
Just what you're thinking. The ones you buy aren't really worth a damn because somebody can always offer them more. So the field's wide open to anybody and it's just like old-fashioned competition again. But if you get the goods on a man, then you've got him. Then there's no higher bidder, and you can count on his friendship. Well, you have friends, and so have I. You have friends I can use, and vice versa. That's all right with me. What the hell? One's got to trade something. If we don't trade money, and the age of money is past, then we trade men.
What is it you're driving at?
Why, I'm just telling you a few things that you ought to remember. Now, take Wesley, for instance. You promised him the assistance job in the Bureau of National Planning for double-crossing Reardon at the time of the Equalization of Opportunity Bill. You had the connections to do it, and that's what I asked you to do, in exchange for the anti-dog-eat-dog rule, where I had the connections. So Wesley did his part, and you saw to it that you got it all on paper. Oh, sure. I know that you've got written proof of the kind of deals he pulled to help pass that bill while he was taking Reardon's money to defeat it and keeping Reardon off guard. They were pretty ugly deals. It would be pretty messy for Mr. Mouch if it all came out in public. So you kept your promise and you got the job for him because you thought you had him. And so you did. And he paid off pretty handsomely, didn't he? But it works only just so long. After a while, Mr. Wesley Mouch might get to be so powerful and the scandal so old that nobody will care how he got his start or whom he double-crossed. Nothing lasts forever. Wesley was Reardon's man, and then he was your man, and he might be somebody else's man tomorrow.
Are you giving me a hint?
Why, no. I'm giving you a friendly warning. We're old friends, Jimmy, and I think that that's what we ought to remain. I think we can be very useful to each other, you and I, if you don't start getting the wrong ideas about friendship. Me? I believe in a balance of power. Did you prevent Mouch from coming here tonight? Well, maybe I did, and maybe I didn't. I'll let you worry about it. That's good for me if I did, and still better if I didn't. Cheryl's eyes followed James Taggart through the crowd. The faces that kept shifting and gathering around her seemed so friendly, and their voices were so eagerly warm that she felt certain there was no malice anywhere in the room. She wondered why some of them talked to her about Washington in a hopeful, confidential manner of half-sentences, half-hints, as if they were seeking her help for something secret she was supposed to understand. She did not know what to say, but she smiled and answered whatever she pleased. She could not disgrace the person of Mrs. Taggart by any touch of fear. Then she saw the enemy. It was a tall, slender figure in a gray evening gown, who was now her sister-in-law. The pressure of anger in Cheryl's mind was the stored accumulation of the sounds of Jim's tortured voice. She felt the nagging pull of a duty left undone. Her eyes kept returning to the enemy and studying her intently. The pictures of Dagny Taggart in the newspapers had shown a figure dressed in slacks, or a face with a slanting hat brim and a raised coat collar. Now she wore a gray evening gown that seemed indecent, because it looked austerely modest, so modest that it vanished from one's awareness and left one too aware of the slender body it pretended to cover. There was a tone of blue in the gray cloth that went with the gunmetal gray of her eyes. She wore no jewelry, only a bracelet on her wrist, a chain of heavy metal links with a green-blue cast. Cheryl waited until she saw Dagny standing alone, then tore forward, cutting resolutely across the room. She looked at close range into the gunmetal eyes that seemed cold and intense at once, the eyes that looked at her directly with a polite, impersonal curiosity. "There's something I want you to know," said Cheryl, her voice taut and harsh, "so that there won't be any pretending about it. I'm not going to put on the sweet relative act. I know what you've done to Jim and how you've made him miserable all his life. I'm going to protect him against you. I'll put you in your place. I'm Mrs. Taggart. I'm the woman in this family now." "That's quite all right," said Dagny. "I'm the man." Cheryl watched her walk away and thought that Jim had been right. This sister of his was a creature of cold evil who had given her no response, no acknowledgement, no emotion of any kind except a touch of something that looked like an astonished, indifferent amusement. Reardon stood by Lillian's side and followed her when she moved. She wished to be seen with her husband. He was complying. He did not know whether anyone looked at him or not. He was aware of no one around them, except the person whom he could not permit himself to see. The image still holding his consciousness was the moment when he had entered this room with Lillian and had seen Dagny looking at them. He had looked straight at her, prepared to accept any blow her eyes would choose to give him. Whatever the consequences to Lillian, he would have confessed his adultery publicly, there and in that moment, rather than commit the unspeakable act of evading Dagny's eyes, of closing his face into a coward's blankness, of pretending to her that he did not know the nature of his action. But there had been no blow. He knew every shade of sensation ever reflected in Dagny's face. He had known that she had felt no shock. He had seen nothing but an untouched serenity. Her eyes had moved to his, as if acknowledging the full meaning of this encounter, but looking at him as she would have looked anywhere, as she looked at him in his office or in her bedroom. It had seemed to him that she had stood before them both, at the distance of a few steps, revealed to them as simply and openly as the gray dress revealed her body. She had bowed to them, the courteous movement of her head including them both. He had answered. He had seen Lillian's brief nod, and then he had seen Lillian moving away and realized that he had stood with his head bowed for a long moment. He did not know what Lillian's friends were saying to him or what he was answering. As a man goes, step by step, trying not to think of the length of a hopeless road, so he went moment by moment, keeping no imprint of anything in his mind. He heard snatches of Lillian's pleased laughter and a tone of satisfaction in her voice. After a while, he noticed the women around him. They all seemed to resemble Lillian, with the same look of static grooming, with thin eyebrows plucked to a static lift and eyes frozen in static amusement. He noticed that they were trying to flirt with him, and that Lillian watched it as if she were enjoying the hopelessness of their attempts. This, then, he thought, was the happiness of feminine vanity which she had begged him to give her. These were the standards which he did not live by, but had to consider. He turned for escape to a group of men. He could not find a single straight statement in the conversation of the men. Whatever subject they seemed to be talking about never seemed to be the subject they were actually discussing. He listened like a foreigner who recognized some of the words, but could not connect them into sentences. A young man with a look of alcoholic insolence staggered past the group and snapped, chuckling, "Learned your lesson, Reardon?" He did not know what the young rat had meant. Everybody else seemed to know it. They looked shocked and secretly pleased. Lillian drifted away from him, as if letting him understand that she did not insist upon his literal attendance. He retreated to a corner of the room where no one would see him or notice the direction of his eyes. Then he permitted himself to look at Dagny. He watched the gray dress, the shifting movement of the soft cloth when she walked, the momentary pauses sculptured by the cloth, the shadows and the light. He saw it as a bluish-gray smoke held shaped for an instant into a long curve that slanted forward to her knee and back to the tip of her sandal. He knew every facet the light would shape if the smoke were ripped away. He felt a murky, twisting pain. It was jealousy of every man who spoke to her. He had never felt it before, but he felt it here, where everyone had the right to approach her, except himself. Then, as if a single sudden blow to his brain blasted a moment's shift of perspective, he felt an immense astonishment at what he was doing here and why. He lost for that moment all the days and dogmas of his past. His concepts, his problems, his pain were wiped out. He knew only, as from a great clear distance, that man exists for the achievement of his desires. And he wondered why he stood here. He wondered who had the right to demand that he waste a single irreplaceable hour of his life when his only desire was to seize the slender figure in gray and hold her through the length of whatever time there was left for him to exist. In the next moment, he felt the shudder of recapturing his mind. He felt the tight, contemptuous movement of his lips pressed together in token of the words he cried to himself. "You made a contract once, now stick to it." And then he thought suddenly that in business transactions the courts of law did not recognize a contract wherein no valuable consideration had been given by one party to the other. He wondered what made him think of it. The thought seemed irrelevant. He did not pursue it. James Taggart saw Lillian Reardon drift casually toward him at the one moment when he chanced to be alone in the dim corner between a potted palm and a window. He stopped and waited to let her approach. He could not guess her purpose, but this was the manner which, in the code he understood, meant that he had better hear her. "How do you like my wedding gift, Jim?" she asked, and laughed at his look of embarrassment. "No, no, don't try to go over the list of things in your apartment, wondering which one the hell it was. It's not in your apartment. It's right here. And it's a non-material gift, darling." He saw the half-hint of a smile on her face, the look understood among his friends as an invitation to share a secret victory. It was the look not of having outthought, but of having outsmarted somebody. He answered cautiously, with a safely pleasant smile, "Your presence is the best gift you could give me." "My presence, Jim?" The The lines of his face were shock-bound for a moment. He knew what she meant, but he had not expected her to mean it. She smiled openly. "We both know whose presence is the most valuable one for you tonight, and the unexpected one. Didn't you really think of giving me credit for it? I'm surprised at you. I thought you had a genius for recognizing potential friends." He would not commit himself. He kept his voice carefully neutral. "Have I failed to appreciate your friendship, Lillian?" "Now, now, darling, you know what I'm talking about. You didn't expect him to come here. You didn't really think that he is afraid of you, did you? But to have the others think he is, that's quite an inestimable advantage, isn't it?" "I'm surprised, Lillian."
"Shouldn't you say impressed?
Your guests are quite impressed. I can practically hear them thinking all over the room. Most of them are thinking, if he has to seek terms with Jim Taggart, we'd better toe the line. And a few were thinking, if he's afraid, we'll get away with much more. This is as you want it, of course, and I wouldn't think of spoiling your triumph, but you and I are the only ones who know that you didn't achieve it single-handed." He did not smile. He asked, his face blank, his voice smooth, but with a carefully measured hint of harshness, "What's your angle?" She laughed. "Essentially, the same as yours, Jim. But speaking practically, none at all. It's just a favor I've done you, and I need no favor in return. Don't worry, I'm not lobbying for any special interests. I'm not after squeezing some particular directive out of Mr. Mouch. I'm not even after a diamond tiara from you. Unless, of course, it's a tiara of a non-material order, such as your appreciation."
He looked straight at her for the first time, his eyes narrowed, his face relaxed to the same half-smile as hers, suggesting the expression which, for both of them, meant that they felt at home with each other, an expression of contempt. "You know that I have always admired you, Lillian, as one of the truly superior women."
"I'm aware of it."
There was the faintest coating of mockery spread, like shellac, over the smooth notes of her voice. He was studying her insolently. "You must forgive me if I think that some curiosity is permissible between friends," he said, with no tone of apology. "I'm wondering from what angle you contemplate the possibility of certain financial burdens or losses which affect your own personal interests." She shrugged.
"From the angle of a horsewoman, darling. If you had the most powerful horse in the world, you would keep it bridled down to the gate required to carry you in comfort, even though this meant the sacrifice of its full capacity, even though its top speed would never be seen and its great power would be wasted. You would do it, because if you let the horse go full blast, it would throw you off in no time. However, financial aspects are not my chief concern. Nor yours, Jim."
"I did underestimate you," he said slowly.
"Oh, well, that's an error I'm willing to help you correct. I know the sort of problem he presents to you. I know why you're afraid of him, as you have good reason to be. But, well, you're in business and in politics, so I'll try to say it in your language. A businessman says that he can deliver the goods, and a ward healer says that he can deliver the vote. Is that right? Well, what I wanted you to know is that I can deliver him any time I choose. You may act accordingly."
In the code of his friends, to reveal any part of one's self was to give a weapon to an enemy. But he signed her confession and matched it when he said, "I wish I were as smart about my sister." She looked at him without astonishment. She did not find the words irrelevant.
"Yes, there's a tough one," she said. "No vulnerable point. No weaknesses.
None. No love affairs? God, no.
She shrugged, in sign of changing the subject. Dagny Taggart was a person on whom she did not care to dwell.
I think I'll let you run along, so that you can chat a little with Balf Eubank, she said. He looks worried, because you haven't looked at him all evening, and he's wondering whether literature will be left without a friend at court.
Lillian, you're wonderful, he said, quite spontaneously.
She laughed. That, my dear, is the non-material tiara I wanted. The remnant of a smile stayed on her face as she moved through the crowd, a fluid smile that ran softly into the look of tension and boredom worn by all the faces around her. She moved at random, enjoying the sense of being seen, her eggshell satin gown shimmering like heavy cream with the motion of her tall figure. It was the green-blue spark that caught her attention. It flashed for an instant under the lights on the wrist of a thin, naked arm. Then she saw the slender body, the gray dress, the fragile, naked shoulders. She stopped. She looked at the bracelet, frowning. Dagny turned at her approach. Among the many things that Lillian resented, the impersonal politeness of Dagny's face was the one she resented most.
"What do you think of your brother's marriage, Miss Taggart?" she asked, casually, smiling.
"I have no opinion about it."
"Do you mean to say that you don't find it worthy of any thought?"
"If you wish to be exact,
yes, that's what I mean."
"Oh, but don't you see any human significance in it?"
"No."
"Don't you think that a person such as your brother's bride does deserve some interest?"
"Why, no."
"I envy you, Miss Taggart. I envy your Olympian detachment. It is, I think, the secret of why lesser mortals can never hope to equal your success in the field of business. They allow their attention to be divided, at least to the extent of acknowledging achievements in other fields."
"What achievements are we talking about?"
"Don't you grant any recognition at all to the women who attain unusual heights of conquest, not in the industrial, but in the human realm?"
"I don't think that there is such a word as conquest in the human realm."
"Oh, but consider, for instance, how hard other women would have had to work, if work were the only means available to them, to achieve what this girl has achieved through the person of your brother."
"I don't think she knows the exact nature of what she has achieved."
Reardon saw them together. He approached. He felt that he had to hear it, no matter what the consequences. He stopped silently beside them. He did not know whether Lillian was aware of his presence. He knew that Dagny was.
"Do show a little generosity toward her, Miss Taggart," said Lillian. "At least the generosity of attention. You must not despise the women who do not possess your brilliant talent, but who exercise their own particular endowments. Nature always balances her gifts and offers compensations. Don't you think so?"
"I'm not sure I understand you."
"Oh, I'm sure you don't want to hear me become more explicit."
"Why, yes, I do."
Lillian shrugged angrily. Among the women who were her friends, she would have been understood and stopped long ago, but this was an adversary new to her, a woman who refused to be hurt. She did not care to speak more clearly, but she saw Reardon looking at her. She smiled and said, "Well, consider your sister-in-law, Miss Taggart. What chance did she have to rise in the world?"
"None.
By your exacting standards. She could not have made a successful career in business. She does not possess your unusual mind. Besides, men would have made it impossible for her. They would have found her too attractive. So she took advantage of the fact that men have standards which, unfortunately, are not as high as yours. She resorted to talents which, I'm sure, you despise. You have never cared to compete with us lesser women in the sole field of our ambition, in the achievement of power over men."
"If you call it power, Mrs. Reardon,
Then, no, I haven't. She turned to go, but Lillian's voice stopped her.
I would like to believe that you're fully consistent, Miss Taggart, and fully devoid of human frailties. I would like to believe that you've never felt the desire to flatter or to offend anyone. But I see that you expected both Henry and me to be here tonight.
Why, no. I can't say that I did. I had not seen my brother's guest list.
Then why are you wearing that bracelet?
Dagny's eyes moved deliberately straight to hers.
I always wear it.
Don't you think that that's carrying a joke too far?
It was never a joke, Mrs. Reardon.
Then you'll understand.